Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden, and here with me in the studio tonight is tonight's co-host, Rob Wyman. Rob is certified by the Board of Legal Specialization, State Bar of California, as a specialist in workers' compensation law, and has served on the Board of Governors of the California Applicants Attorneys Association, a group that advocates for the rights of injured California workers. Rob?
Good evening, Jeff. It's fun to co-host with you tonight, and we're doing something a little bit different because this is a legal show, and I'm an attorney, and so we frequently discussed the peculiarities of the law, but workers' compensation is also about medicine. And a little side note, I mean, people ask me, well, did law school prepare you for this job? And I said, no, my undergraduate degree in psychology prepared me for this job much more than my law school training.
Sounds like you've met some of my clients, but that's a different story.
So I thought it would be a good idea to have a physician on. We've never had a physician on the show, and probably because when my clients call me, they're not asking me about the law so much. They're asking me about medical stuff. And those are the questions I field more often than any. And a lot of my job is I'm reading medical reports and medical books more than I'm reading law books. So medicine is a huge part of our system. So I thought it's about time we have a physician on. And this is Dr. Alex Abel Smith, who is with us tonight.
Well, you know, you mentioned to me when we were setting the show up that Dr. Sable Smith is both a treating physician and a qualified medical evaluator. And I got to ask you, Rob, what is a qualified medical evaluator?
Okay. We have basically two types of physicians in our system. The doctors who provide the actual treatment and doctors who write medical legal reports to resolve legal and medical issues. Did this injury happen at work? What is the level of disability? And things of that nature. So the qualified medical evaluators are just answering legal questions for the most part and resolving medical disputes, but they don't provide treatment. They just write reports, whereas the treating physician provides the treatment. And let me just start by saying that we refer to our doctors, and this has caused some confusion with our clients too, as primary treating physicians, the PTP. And our clients sometimes get confused with their own private practice primary doctor.
PCP.
PCP. But you, Dr. Sable Smith, are a PTP.
Primary treating physician.
Right.
In the work comp system.
So when someone comes in to see you, as the primary treating physician, one of the questions I get is like, well, what specialty should, who should I see? What specialty should I go to? And I point out to them that to me, the primary treating physician is sort of the quarterback of the whole thing. You're not necessarily the only physician involved, are you, in terms of treatment?
No, more often than not, there are at least one, maybe two or three or more physicians involved in the treatment of a patient in the workers' compensation system. This job actually reminds me a lot of my original training in medicine, which was as a family medicine physician, and it's that quarterback role as your regular family doctor. It's the same thing in workers' compensation. So my job is to see the patient, you know, figure out what's going on, figure out what I can do to help that person, and when I might need to refer them to a specialist.
So, for example, they have a bad knee. You're going to try and treat them non-surgically, if at all possible. But if they need if they need knee surgery, you can then refer them out to a surgeon.
Exactly. Or if I just want to get another opinion from a surgeon on whether they think a surgery would be beneficial for that person.
And they're known as the secondary treating physician. And there's some importance to that, too, because
they don't have to do all the paperwork.
They don't have to do all the paperwork. And we rely upon you to pull together all the opinion, you know, the internist because they've got stomach issues, or the acupuncturist. What's your role in sort of pulling all that together?
Yeah, it's involves a lot of tracking down medical records. The health system in general, not just in workers' compensation, it's very hard, you know, if you're getting treatment in two different medical systems, like say you go to Stanford for one doctor and you go to Sutter or Dignity for another, it's hard to see records. In workers' compensation, it's almost impossible to see records, even though we're using electronic health systems. There's not a lot of talking between them. So I'm spending a lot of time tracking down notes from the surgeon or from the podiatrist or from the internal medicine specialist. I see my role, too, as not just providing medical treatment, but there's just so much friction and barriers to getting things done in the system. My role is to kind of move those things out of the way and help the patient navigate the system as well.
Now, you work as a qualified medical evaluator, but also as a treating physician. Can you do both with the same patient?
Short answer is no. So a lot of treating physicians are also qualified medical evaluators, and almost all qualified medical evaluators treat patients in one way or the other. But you can't wear both hats for the same patient. And the reason is, you're, as a qualified medical evaluator, you're an independent party. You're an independent, almost like a third-party witness, or expert witness, I should say, in that case. And so if you have a doctor-patient treating relationship with that person, that may bias you in your decision-making.
Let me welcome you to Your Legal Rights. And to those listening, we're always eager to hear from you and hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Once again, that's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking about workers' compensation law, but also treatment, medical legal evaluations. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation, but do bear in mind our guests can't provide you precise medical or legal advice, as we don't have the entire facts relating to your case or your treatment. We're happy to pass along the principles to guide you in your decision-making. And as always, their guidance mightn't be the positions of their respective patients, employers, clients, but again, my guests, my co-hosts, we're all here to help and to inform. And before we go further, let me turn it over to Eduardo in San Lorenzo. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks for taking the call. Hey, so I have an unusual situation. I clean homes for a living, and I was harvesting some antique lighters, and I felt something pop, and I got a lot of pain in my elbow, and I went to go see, you know, a doctor about it, because I was making a claim against, you know, workman's comp. You know, my company sent me to this guy, and he says, yeah, it's, what do you call it, wear and tear and overuse. I guess it's the short version. But I really like that doctor, and I wanted him to treat me. He said he can't. So what's the deal on that?
Well, there could be, this is Rob, there could be a couple of reasons. Most insurance companies and most employers have a medical provider network. And to get treatment in the workers' compensation system, you have to pick a doctor within the network that's set up by the insurance company. Now, there are exceptions to that. It's a type of thing that's complicated enough that we probably couldn't answer your question fully tonight. But you would start by just asking them, you know, will you allow this doctor to be my treating physician? The insurance company is allowed to let you treat outside of their network. They don't usually. But if they don't have an adequate network, if they don't have a reasonable choice of doctors in your geographic area, you can get out of that network and go to a doctor of your choice. It's the sort of thing that you probably want to talk to a workers' compensation lawyer about in more detail. That's something that comes up a lot in my practice. That's why a lot of clients come to see me, is trying to find an appropriate treating physician. So that's probably the best answer I can give to you tonight, is that you might be stuck in their network. There might be some excellent doctors in that network, and a good workers' compensation attorney knows who the good physicians are and who you want to avoid. And they can also help you maybe get outside that network and stick with the doctor that you're seeing.
But, and this is a question for both of you, does Eduardo have to go to any special doctor, or can he start out with his own regular doctor?
Injured workers can pre-designate doctors, but they rarely do. So I'm going to assume that Eduardo hasn't, because no one does.
I went to my regular doctor, but he said he's like a family doctor.
And frequently the family doctors just don't want to get involved. Oh, sorry, I cut you off there, Eduardo. Go ahead.
That's okay. He just said I needed to go see an orthopedic doctor.
Okay. Well, you can pick all sorts of specialties. You could go see an orthopedic surgeon. Personally, I like to refer people to pain management physicians or physical med and rehab doctors, because surgeons see the whole world through a scalpel. That's the solution to everything, is to operate. And I think sometimes seeing a pain management specialist or physical med and rehab specialist, they'll take a more holistic look, and they'll send you to a surgeon if that's what you need. But I highly recommend, if you don't, you go on the California Applicants Attorney's website. You can find a list of attorneys there. There's no charge for an initial consultation. Go to the local bar association's lawyer referral service. They'll help you find an attorney. You'll get a free consultation, and they'd be better able to direct you as to how to get the best doctor.
And in San Lorenzo, that would be the Alameda County Bar Association. Their number is 510-302-2222. And they've got a lawyer referral service. You could actually, it's not free, but you could sit down with a lawyer for a half an hour, get a consultation for somewhere in the neighborhood of $30.
Yeah, and I don't know about Alameda, but the fee's waived for workers' compensation. I know in San Mateo and San Francisco, it's probably waived in Alameda too. So that would be my recommendation to you, Eduardo.
Okay. Thank you for listening.
Oh, thank you for calling in.
My question.
Thank you for joining us.
Jeff, you put out this wonderful
guide as to how to start.
And I jumped right into technical stuff and right into the subject matter without even allowing our esteemed guest to introduce himself and tell us a little bit about him. Dr. Sablesmith, what's your specialty? Where do you work? Where did you go to medical school? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Where do I begin? Well, first off, thanks so much for inviting me to be on this show. I currently practice pain medicine. My medical journey, I guess, goes back to medical school at University of Missouri, which is where I am originally from. I then moved to Denver, Colorado, where I did a family medicine residency at the University of Colorado. And I moved out to California to do a fellowship in hospice and palliative medicine. And I did that for a little over 2 years at the VA in Palo Alto. I had an interest in starting to use my hands more in medicine and in palliative care. We treated a lot of patients in pain. And I knew there were a lot of procedures, injections, things that could be done to alleviate pain and suffering. And so I thought it would be an interesting path to go down to pursue more training in interventional pain management. So I went in hoping to learn more about injections and anatomy, and I did, but also really the importance of seeing the whole person and treating the whole person as being really necessary to treating chronic pain. Believe it or not, it was my training in palliative medicine that really has served me very well in that regard, where we're used to working with not just physicians, but other folks in the medical system, nurses, psychologists, social workers, to really understand all aspects of someone's pain experience. So anyway, I then did a pain management fellowship at Stanford, and that's how I that was my jumping off point into pain management.
All right, slightly personal question, but why did you go into medicine? Don't you have a family history in radio?
I do have a family history in radio.
The question coming from someone who's sitting across from me who has a face for radio.
My mother was a radio DJ on KOPN in Columbia, Missouri. And then my brother followed in her footsteps, and he is a journalist, and he worked at the University of Missouri and Columbia, Missouri NPR affiliate, KBIA.
So public radio is in your blood.
It is.
That's why I'm glad you're here tonight. So you go into medicine, and here's a question that gets asked of me all the time. They said, Rob, how did you become a workers' compensation lawyer? Is that something you want to do in law school? I said, I didn't know workers' compensation existed when I was in law school.
You know, that is a salient question, I think. Why workers' comp?
Glutton for punishment, or?
It was the right place at the right time.
Okay.
If you had asked me before, I you wouldn't have been able to pay me to go into workers' compensation. In medicine, work comp is notorious for involving lots of administrative work, paperwork, having to deal with insurance company denials, even more so than regular medical care, where that's also a facet of life. But at my circumstances, at the time, I reconnected with Steve Feinberg, who's a well-known workers' compensation physician in the Bay Area, and I met him originally at Stanford during pain fellowship. He recruited me to his practice. That was almost 2 years ago. It's been a bumpy road, you know, getting acquainted with the workers' compensation system. But what's kept me in it, I think, is a more relevant question now, is you can really see you are positioned to really make a huge difference in people's lives. And, you know, these aren't made-for-TV, you know, life-or-death medical moments, but you know, if you have someone who relies on their body to make a living, and they're on a trajectory where it's looking like they're headed for, you know, a life of disability, you can really get them on the right path towards rehabilitation and get them back to work and a livelihood. So it's been really gratifying to see that change.
So the way this typically works, someone comes into my office, they're treating at one of these industrial clinics, and the first thing we do, I mean, there's some fine physicians in those clinics, but they're not set up for long-term care. They're set up to do a quick suture of a laceration or something like that. So the first thing I try to do is get them out of that clinic and into a private practice. So I pick you, and I write to the insurance company and get authorization, and then they're supposed to send you the whole medical file. And then my client shows up at your office. What happens at the first appointment?
So the first appointment is really all about getting to know someone. I might pack too much into the first appointment. That may be why I run behind all the time in my schedule. But what I do beforehand is review the medical records that have been sent, try to get a sense of what the injury was, what diagnostic testing like x-rays or MRIs have been done, what other treatments have been done, physical therapy, acupuncture, chiropractic treatment. When someone shows up to the office, I tell them just that. I want to get to know you today. I keep it open-ended at the beginning, let them tell their story about what happened. And often just kind of keeping my mouth shut is the best way to get valuable information from someone. And then once they've said their piece, I ask clarifying questions. I do a physical exam. I think it's really important, especially when you're first meeting someone, to really do a good physical exam. A, it helps you get good medical information and form a diagnosis. But it really helps establish a good rapport with someone. A lot of folks feel like they've been moved through a industrial clinic without much personal attention. And so it really goes a long way to help form that doctor-patient relationship and a trusting one at that. And then at the end, I go over, you know, what are the – do I think they've been given the right diagnosis before? Are there any gaps in treatment, any other treatments that I think they need, any other doctors I think they need to see, or any other diagnostic testing?
And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that you like to spend a lot of time with them at the initial appointment. My first boss told me that every 5 minutes, extra 5 minutes I spent with the client at the first appointment is going to save me hours down the road. Do you find that to be
yes.
true? Yeah, yeah.
It's a very worthwhile investment.
Okay. And just a reminder, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Robert Wyman. I'm co-host tonight with Jeff Hayden. And tonight we're discussing workers' compensation and the medical legal evaluations and treatment. Our guest is Dr. Alex Sable-Smith. He practices both a treating physician and a qualified medical evaluator. And if you have any questions for me as an attorney or hopefully Dr. Sable-Smith, you all have heard from me enough. Please give us a call, and our number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local dialing area, you can call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you may call regarding any question you have on tonight's topic, workers' compensation and medical treatment and evaluations. You're not limited to the point we're at in the conversation. Any question you have about the treatment process, please give us a call. We'll be happy to try and answer your questions.
Do you do all of the treatment yourself, or do you have a team with – to what extent do you have RNs and physicians assistants and the various almost doctors?
So it will vary depending on what clinic you go to. Some doctors, it's just the physician, maybe a nurse, medical assistant, and most doctors practice with a physician assistant or a nurse practitioner as well. Other clinics have many other practitioners. So at our clinic, we have a physical therapist, a psychologist, a trainer who works with a physical therapist on rehabilitation, work conditioning, things like that, which is – work conditioning is a special form of physical therapy, a more intense one. And other clinics may have a chiropractor, an acupuncturist, as well as many physicians.
In terms of the nurse practice – and I'm going to try not to get political here, and I don't want to anger the folks up in Sacramento, but – my understanding is that the burdens that have been placed on the treating physician and workers' compensation have just increased over the years. And the compensation has not increased with the amount of work that they want you to do. And I'm told that it's standard practice now to be assisted by nurse practitioners and physician's assistants just so that you can see the patients that you need to see. I want to be able to send a lot of patients to you, a lot of clients, my clients, your patients. And the nurse practitioners and the physician assistants, I've told my clients, are invaluable resources. And to expect that you won't see the physician on every visit, that frequently you will see the nurse practitioner or the PA.
Exactly. And this isn't limited to the workers' compensation system, but the medical system as a whole. In order to meet the need that patients have to get into practices, it's really common in all medical practices to have a nurse practitioner or physician assistant. So in our practice, for example, we have one nurse practitioner. Usually they'll see alternate visits, or every third visit is with the doctor. The others are with the nurse practitioner. If I saw every patient in follow-up who I saw as a new patient, I simply wouldn't have the capacity to see more new patients.
And there's an economy also involved. Ultimately, you don't see any patients if you can't keep the doors open.
Exactly.
Let me turn it to Lisa in Berkeley. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, I had to turn the radio off. So, Dr. Sable-Smith, I am one of your former patients. You treated me on your fellowship at Stanford.
Oh, hello.
Hello. It was funny. I was driving down the road, and I sent you, and I just was curious where you're practicing. I wondered where you ended up, and I would love to be able to refer people to you.
My current practice, so I am just seeing workers' compensation patients at this time, but I'm at a practice called Feinberg Medical Group in Palo Alto, right across the street, right across El Camino from the Stanford campus.
That's great. That's good to know. I do some work with patient advocacy, and I do occasionally get some workers' comp referrals. So I'm really happy to know that you went into that. I think it's a great fit.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, we're glad to have him on board. I've known Steve Feinberg myself for 30 years. He's been a tireless advocate for injured workers. There's another physician there, Dr. Wiedemeyer, great guy. So it is a wonderful group, and if an injured worker needs a physician, it's a great place to go. Again, we have this issue of the medical provider network. You're not able to see everybody. You're not in some of the networks. You're in quite a few of them, though. So I recommend this group to as many clients as I can.
Well, that's good to know. I'm happy to hear that you're practicing in that capacity, and it's great to hear you on the radio tonight. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. Thanks so much for calling in. It was great to hear
from you. Lisa, thank you.
And I'll join in that. Lisa, thank you for calling on your legal rights. And it was really great to hear from you. Thank you.
Okay, really quickly, see, you've gone through the initial appointment and they come into you for treatment and you want to do an injection into their knee or their elbow or something. What's the difference in trying to get approval through workers' comp versus a regular, you know, non-work injury?
Here's where all the fun begins in the workers' comp system. So, you know, you're used to going to the doctor. They may prescribe something for you, you know, antibiotic or a pain reliever, whatever. They put the prescription into the computer. It goes to the pharmacy. The pharmacy has it ready in 30 minutes, an hour. Now, maybe for the really expensive things, like a really expensive medication or surgery, it has to go through a prior authorization process before insurance will approve it. Well, in workers' compensation, every single thing, whether it's Tylenol or a knee replacement, has to go through prior authorization. So let's take that injection as an example. So I'll put in a request to the insurance company to approve this injection. It's called a request for authorization, or RFA. And only if and in my note, I have to carefully justify why I think the patient would benefit from this injection, and have to comment on whether it meets the a particular set of guidelines that we can get into later, called the California Medical Treatment Utilization Schedule. Anyway, I have to justify why we're going to do that. Only if it is approved can I then schedule the patient to do the injection.
I think we might be coming up on a break. Jeff, do we?
We are getting pretty close. This would be a good time. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. And we will be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So you weren't quite finished, but you were telling us why sometimes you'll prescribe something and it just doesn't always get approved quickly. Is that could be the same whether it's a prescription or a shot or
anything. So we send that request for authorization into the insurance company. They are supposed to respond within a certain time frame, and then we receive that authorization or a denial. Sometimes we get no response, though that's not as common. If it's authorized, there's even more work. We have to put in, say it's an injection that I do, you know, we'd bring the person into the clinic and I do the injection. But if it's a referral, say I'm referring someone to an orthopedic surgeon, we then have to get the list of orthopedic surgeons who are in the network, in the medical provider network. Then I have to select a surgeon off of that list, and then the referral gets sent to their clinic. Then it's in the hands of that surgical clinic to schedule someone. Often there are third-party companies that work for the insurance companies that do the scheduling and arranging appointments for imaging, diagnostic testing, your MRI, X-ray, things like that, or your physical therapy appointments. So there's lots of cooks in the kitchen here. It makes it very hard to navigate. And when things don't go as planned, it's often difficult to figure out where the holdup was.
But what can you do? I mean, either they don't respond or they say, no, we don't think so. What can you do next? I mean, there's got to be some recourse to get treatments approved.
There is. We can appeal treatments that have been denied by insurance. It's a cumbersome process, and to be honest, we just don't have the capacity to appeal every single thing. But we try as hard as we can to appeal treatments based on, you know, their medical necessity. And if the appeal is denied, there's even another course of action called independent medical review.
And that's kind of where I come in, Jeff. I mean, from what I like is to see something approved. That makes my life simple. And if it doesn't get approved, if the injured worker has an attorney, the insurance company has to send them this whole packet of information. We won't go into the details. And then we can then file an appeal with this thing called independent medical review in Sacramento. It's not a very good system. They tend to uphold most of the denials. But we put that appeal through every single time. Now, the interesting thing you point out, Jeff, is what if they just don't respond? Now, that's where I can do something. Because if they don't respond timely, now I get to go to a workers' compensation judge and say they blew their chance to review this. They didn't respond in time. So frequently, if there's no response, I'll tell my clients, first of all, do not call the insurance adjuster and remind them that they have a deadline they're about to blow tomorrow. Let's let them blow the deadline. And then I can file for a hearing, and a workers' comp judge will typically say, yeah, you blew the deadline. This appears to be a reasonable course of treatment. I'm going to authorize it. In fact, we file for the hearings. We tell them you blew the deadline, and usually they just say, fine, we'll authorize the treatment, and then we cancel the hearing.
So unlike a contract, in this instance, absence of response may be tantamount to approving.
It pretty much is. I mean, technically, it would go to a workers' compensation judge, and that judge would do what we used to do in the olden days. We'd go to, in front of a judge, say, this is what the doctor wants, and the judge would make a decision. Yeah, I think this is reasonable treatment. And the judges generally deferred to the physicians. So we usually got the treatment authorized. And that's why typically if they simply don't respond, I'll file for a hearing, and I'll get a call from the adjuster saying, fine, yeah, we blew the deadline. We'll authorize the injection. And that's where I can help out a bit.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden, joined in the studio by tonight's co-host, Rob Wyman. Tonight, we're talking workers' compensation and both medical and legal aspects of workers' compensation law with tonight's guest, Dr. Alex Sable-Smith. Dr. Sable-Smith practices both as a treating physician and as a qualified medical evaluator. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And yes, you can call us regarding any question in this arena. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation.
So getting back to the treatment issue, you're providing hands-on treatment for your patients, but you also have to write regular reports. And in those reports, mm-hmm. you're making determinations about whether someone can return to work or not. if they need temporary restrictions while they're recovering, whether they need to be off work altogether. And then at some point, you're going to write what we call the disability report. And the legal phrase is permanent and stationary, when a worker has leveled off, stabilized, maximum medical improvement. These are all the phrases that we hear. So you're treating a patient. You've done all you can do for them. They don't seem to be getting much better. They don't seem to be getting much worse. That's when you would write that permanent and stationary report.
Exactly. The ideal situation is someone returns to their prior baseline. Their symptoms go away completely. I don't see that as often. I think my sample is a bit skewed since I see patients pretty much all who have developed chronic symptoms. But yes, the medical concept we call maximum medical improvement, and that is, have we done all appropriate and reasonable medical treatment, or at least considered it, and then have reasons for not pursuing different things? So if we considered all appropriate treatment, and has the person's condition plateaued or stabilized? So it's not getting a lot better and it's not getting a lot worse. We call that maximum medical improvement. And in that disability report, one of the really important aspects of that are permanent work restrictions. So at that new baseline, what can the injured worker do? What can't they do? And we think about restrictions both in terms of safety. So, you know, if you lost a hand in the accident, it may not be safe to operate heavy machinery or climb ladders from heights. Just random examples there. And then prophylactic restrictions are ones that we put in place to avoid major flares in pain or other symptoms.
So someone can lift 20 pounds, but you're going to suggest that they not do it to protect their back.
Exactly. They could lift 20 pounds, but it's, you know, you wouldn't want them doing it day in and day out.
Okay. So at some point in that report, you're also going to give them an impairment rating. You're going to give them a percentage. You're going to say you're 5% disabled, 10% disabled. Is there I'm leading you towards the book.
Yes.
The infamous AMA guides. It's a book put out by the AMA that doctors are to use in California to determine impairment. So that's where you start, right? You get that book out.
Exactly. So the law in California tells us that we have to use this book, the AMA guides, and specifically the fifth edition of the AMA guides, in order to determine the permanent impairment or disability of an injured worker.
And the interesting thing about that guides is, from a lawyer's perspective, I think it's kind of a conservative book. I think sometimes it doesn't really adequately allow an adequate impairment level for injured workers. But thanks to some very clever physicians, we'll mention Steve Feinberg again and a couple of others, there are ways that you can sort of get around a strict interpretation of that book. So in other words, you see a patient and the book is telling you to give them 2%, but you think, wow, this person's really disabled. 2% doesn't seem adequate. What can you do about that?
Well, I'll go back and say the intent of the AMA guides is excellent and noble. Determining how disabled someone is a fairly subjective determination, and there's wide variety depending on what physician you see. And so the AMA guides were developed in an attempt to bring uniformity and more objective measures to the determination of disability. I don't know exactly how many pages it is because I use an electronic copy now, but I don't know. Let's say there's 1,000 pages. Even within those 1,000 pages, they just don't account for all situations. So let's just give an example of a back injury. You know, when someone has a back injury and say they developed sciatica, so pain shooting down the leg from that back injury, say they had a herniated disc causing that. Well, in the AMA guides, there's a certain percentage that I assign to someone who has chronic sciatica type symptoms after a back injury. So I think it's between 13 and 18% or something like that. But there's many other scenarios that aren't that cut and dry, and not everyone's body reads the textbook when they get injured. And so there may not be a what we call a strict rating. There may not be a table that says how to provide a rating to someone with a certain injury. And in California, again, this is based on case law, I believe. Doctors are allowed to assign a impairment rating as long as it is contained somewhere within the AMA guides.
I have a favorite example I like to give. It's a physician who's passed away now. He was a dear friend of the community and really actively involved in workers' compensation. And we were talking one day, and he said, the problem with the guides, that a lot of it has to do with range of motion for the back.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I have a patient who has pretty good range of motion, but you can't lift anything. And the back chapter doesn't address lifting. So he would go over to the hernia chapter, which is all about lifting. And by analogy, he would give them a rating. That's just one example that always comes to mind where and that used to shock the heck out of the defense attorneys. They'd say, well, doctor, this person doesn't have a hernia. I know they don't, but this is the best way for me to describe their disability and give them an adequate disability rating.
The way I think about it is first, before even thinking about the guides, is to think about what is their disability? What is it that they can't do or have more difficulty doing? Now after the injury, so that maybe that's they have difficulty lifting, they have difficulty reaching their arm up to comb their hair or wash their hair. Then once I know what the disability is, I can look to see in the guides if there's a adequate description for the injury they had. But if not, then I look, okay, what other conditions that are in the book share the same type of disability? Is there another condition that makes it hard to, say, wash your hair, comb your hair, lift things up with your right arm? And that is how I might determine the rating in that case.
So isn't pain per se, though, subjective? I could have the same injury as somebody else who lives next door, and yet my experience, I just blow past it. It doesn't seem that harsh. The same identical injury next door may have somebody laid up. I mean, isn't there a whole lot of variable in the way that I would experience it in somebody else?
So much variability. And that doesn't mean that the person who with the same injury who is experiencing more pain, it doesn't mean they're making it up. But every human experiences pain in a very different way. And the reason is, I mean, I'm going off on a tangent here, but this is what interests me. Pain is always a sensory and emotional experience. So pain, we couldn't have pain without the brain, and we wouldn't necessarily have pain without changes in the body as well. And so the changes in the body, even if they're the same in two people, may cause a totally different pain experience in those two people, depending on how their nervous system and brain process the pain on their prior experiences as well.
So you've looked through the book, you've provided that impairment rating, you give a percentage to the injured worker, you describe their work restrictions. A lot of my clients will start to panic. They'll think that their case is over, but they can continue even after you said they're permanent stationary. They can continue to get treatment, correct?
Yes. So if someone has chronic symptoms, I mean, in my case, I see primarily patients with chronic pain. That does warrant future medical treatment, and we call that future medical care in the workers' compensation system. And so that treatment is, you know, not intended to cure, though of course we certainly would celebrate if someone, you know, gets better and better and better until they don't have pain anymore. But that treatment is intended to help someone maintain the level of functioning that they got to at the point that they reached that maximum medical improvement.
Yeah, because that's a lot of my clients get very nervous. They think, oh, I this means I can't see my doctor anymore. And I explain to them, no. The doctor will say in that report, you know, they're 10% disabled, no heavy lifting, and they need ongoing medical care.
So when we read something in the report, such as stationary or permanent, we're talking about reaching that level where they're at their highest level of functioning that they're probably going to get.
Yes. That's that. Maximum medical improvement, permanent and stationary, both those essentially mean the same thing, that plateau of function.
So you've written your report, and I've had a look at it, the insurance company's had a look at it, and maybe someone doesn't like it. And since you're a QME, let's take a few minutes and talk about that. So as a treating physician, you get to write a report, and that report's admissible in front of a workers' compensation judge. But if either side is unhappy, they can go get a qualified medical examiner. And this is something I think is important to point out to our listeners. We also have doctors that are known as agreed medical examiners. And if there's an agreed medical examiner, they're the final say for all practical purposes. Now, they're supposed to look at the treating physician's reports, the secondary physician's reports, the family doctor's reports, but that's sort of the final say.
Is that more or less the medical equivalent of an arbitration? We both agreed they're going to make the final decision?
They're going to make the call. And what that doctor says goes. And sometimes they make mistakes, so we can depose them and we can get clarification. But in the QME process, so you've written your report, someone objects, the insurance company objects, perhaps I object, someone doesn't like your report for whatever reason, we're going to go get a QME. And it's important to note that the QME doctor is going to do an evaluation. They're going to write a report. And if we have to go to court, normally we work things out, but if we have to go to court, a judge can rely upon either report, either the treating doctor's report or the QME doctor. They carry equal weight. And it's helpful when the treating doctor is also a QME because that gives them a little more oomph to the workers' compensation judges. So let's talk about your role as a QME. When you do an examination, you're not seeing the patient. Maybe you'll see them a few times, but you're not seeing them regularly. Sometimes you might just see them once.
Exactly, yes.
And as you pointed out earlier, it's happened. My clients have gone to a QME and said, oh, that's such a nice doctor. Can they be my treating doctor? And I said, no. Once they're your QME, they can't provide treatment.
You know, in civil tort cases, particularly personal injury, oftentimes the insurance company will have a doctor and perform an IME, which is basically an insurance doctor. How does an IME and a QME differ?
Yeah, we really don't have IMEs in workers' comp anymore. Back in the day, we'd have the treating physician would write a report, and then I could go out as the injured worker's attorney and pick any doctor I want to write a report, and the insurance company could go out and pick any doctor they want to write a report. Now, we technically still have IMEs in our system, but they're extremely rare. Sometimes we show up at court and the case is a mess. None of the doctors agree on anything. It's almost as if they've seen three different patients, and the judge will say, this is a mess. These are all three fine doctors, but I don't know what's going on here. And the judge is allowed to appoint an IME. That's the only time we have IMEs in our system, is if a judge says, I just can't – these reports aren't working for me. Now, typically – and it's so rare that typically the judge will say, well, go back and get clarification from the doctors. Let's try and clear up this mess. And so that's what we'll do. But on occasion, a judge can appoint an independent medical evaluator if they just feel that the reports they have are not sufficient. So it's pretty rare in our system. And the QME process is a process by which one of the parties applies to the state of California. They're given a list of three doctors. Each side strikes a doctor, and the doctor remaining, I guess, to do the evaluation. Now, does your examination differ much when you're doing a QME versus a treatment exam?
I mean, the QME exam is very thorough. So, for example, these past 2 weeks, I've seen I don't know, 5 or 6 patients with injuries to their wrists and hand. And that is one of the most tedious exams to do because you're taking individual measurements of all the joints of the finger and the wrist and move it this way, move it that way. But the reason is that you are trying to get as much information as possible to provide an impairment rating, again, based on that book, the AMA guides.
But I would think that also you're not going to be seeing them a month, 6 months, a year into treatment. So you're trying to project from the beginning where they're going to end in a way that you don't get to do when you see them periodically.
That too. You want to, you have, I mean, I spend a lot of time with patients in the QME, but during that hour, hour and a half of the initial visit, I'm trying to get as much information as I can, both based on their physical exam and what they're telling me. And then I also usually get a stack of medical records to review as well. We were talking about independent medical evaluators. It's confusing terminology. The QME or qualified medical evaluator, well, we're also serving as an independent party in this. You know, we're not the treating doctor. We're not working for the insurance. We're objectively evaluating the case and providing our medical opinion. And so we are independent in that regard, but just in the system, we happen to be called QMEs.
Yeah, we just try to avoid the IME word because the state has given you a new title, mm-hmm. and it's QME, and we just don't want to confuse people. Jeff, getting back to your question earlier, you had asked about seeing them into the future, and I just want to mention briefly that quite often the QME, from Laura's point of view, comes in early in the case and at the end, because frequently people come to see me and say, my claim's been denied.
Or the closers.
And they want a neutral doctor, an independent doctor, although we don't like using that word. We want a QME to determine, is this an industrial injury? So my client will go see the QME and they'll say, yeah, it's an industrial injury. Then the treating doctor takes over. And then typically we'll send them back. Not always. Sometimes the treating doctor will write a disability report and say, we're all fine with this. Or either side can say, nah, I want to go back to the QME and have that doctor sort of write a final report, the closing report.
Mm-hmm.
And so you will sometimes see people twice, I assume. Once at the beginning to see, is this work-related or not? And then once to determine that those disability issues. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's I've seen people in all stages of the process, but those are the most common. Early in the stage of an injury where, say, there's a dispute about whether the person was actually injured at work and the extent of their injury. So I see a lot of those. And then, exactly right, at the end. When, treatment has been given and we need to determine what the future medical needs are and their disability.
Well, we've reached pretty much the end of the time. I did promise each of you that I would give you a couple of minutes for any closing thoughts, anything you wanted to say. And Dr. Sablesmith, let me start with you. Want to take a couple of minutes and impart any wisdom, anything you wanted to say?
Well, again, thanks so much for having me. I just want people to know how most people have experience with the healthcare system in one way or the other, and it's not an easy thing. Even when doctors get sick, we are often reminded how challenging it is to be a patient and to navigate things. And it's even harder in the workers' compensation system. And so I think it's really important to keep in mind that the system exists. It's out there, and it's serving a lot of people who you interact with on your day-to-day life. And it's really, really important for people to be able to see quality physicians, quality physical therapists, and other practitioners in the workers' compensation system because if not, there can be really devastating consequences. People lose their livelihoods. I see a lot of people moving out of the Bay Area, either often to the Central Valley where cost of living is less or out of state. So it's a really important system that is, I think, not well recognized.
And probably doesn't get the attention and oversight that it probably could.
doesn't get the attention it could. And it's I'll say too to any medical practitioners out there, yes, it is cumbersome, but it's also a really important position to have and a really needed one and interesting one.
And undoubtedly quite rewarding. I'd like to give you a couple minutes also, Rob. This is your bailiwick, so take us home.
Yeah, I'm just going to dovetail on that because clients will come to see me, and the dirty little secret is sometimes I don't do a lot of legal work on cases. And if it sounds like I'm making a plug to use an attorney, I am. If I can see someone early on in their injury, I can get them to the good treating doctor, and I tell them, if we get you to a good treating physician, you're not going to need me to solve a lot of legal issues. And looking up a doctor on Yelp or asking a neighbor, it doesn't really work that well in workers' compensation. There's some physicians out there that are fine physicians, but they just don't have the training in workers' compensation. They don't know how to write the reports. And my client can end up with a bad result. And the other thing is that the clients will come to see me sometimes with one of those QME doctors, and it's a bad report. And that's why I remind them, that's not the end of it. The insurance company will tell you that, hey, the QME says you're fine. You absolutely have the right to have your treating doctor write a report and give another opinion other than that of the QME. And we see that a lot, and we really rely upon the smart, good treating doctors to get our clients out of that mess from a bad QME report.
Getting to a good doctor early is really important.
It's the most important thing I do. It really is.
And, of course, a good workers' compensation attorney can guide you through what those rights are.
We
can always tell you if you have a right to have another doctor write a report, you do. If you have a right to treat with a certain doctor, maybe you do, maybe you don't.
Yeah. And knowing who the physicians are. That's so important, to know who the good physicians are, to know which specialty to send someone to. That's probably the most important thing I do.
And not only good in terms of medical care, but also good in terms of how to navigate the system so you don't end up being shortchanged at some point in the future.
Exactly.
When it comes down to it, most people just want to get better and get on with their lives.
Yeah, they do. They want to get back to work.
They want to get back to work.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight we've been discussing workers' compensation system, both medical and legal aspects of the workers' compensation system. Our guest tonight has been Dr. Alex Sable-Smith, triple board certified and trained at some of the top institutions in the country, and taking time out to talk with all of us. Tonight's show was produced by Rob Wyman and yours truly. Next week on Your Legal Rights, we take a look at landlord-tenant law. Please tune in, and as always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to tonight's co-host, Rob Wyman, and tonight's guest, Dr. Alex Sable-Smith. And on behalf of Your Legal Rights, a big thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe, have a great night, and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.